Davidson. I like this Davidson.
It's the Bottom Line Podcast.
With your host,
Davidson Baker.
Oh, hello. We are live. Just getting this quick shared up onto Twitter on my account. For those of you who do not know or maybe experiencing this for the first time, if you don't know, well, hey, at least you do now. Welcome to the Bottom Line Podcast. And if this is the Bottom Line Podcast, it could only mean that I'm your host, Davidson Baker. And I have a fantastic episode for you, full of fight fan action. Again, I've noticed and put on Twitter and Facebook alike. Go ahead and like and subscribe if you do like this content. And this is for fight fans only. So it is episode 12 of the MMA Bottom Line, the 29th edition of the Bottom Line period. Get this last share up. Get this last share up. And there we go. And live. Okay, so got a lot to go over today, starting with the UFC 227 post-mortem, if you will. I'm a little late. It's been a week since the fights happened. I had plenty to think about and plenty to go over with it. My article over at the MMATakeover.com, I was actually in charge of the matchmaking article this week. Shout out to my good editor, Keith Schillen, for trusting me with such power. And without further ado, let's get started. Of course, starting with TJ Dillashaw defeating Cody Garbrandt 4 minutes and 10 seconds into the first round. I think it was so painfully obvious that Cody Garbrandt fought with raw emotion. And it echoed what he did in the first fight. Nonetheless, TJ Dillashaw has slammed the door for good on the whole Dillashaw one side, Garbrandt or Team Alpha Male rivalry, if you will. So with that being said, where does TJ go from here? First of all, before you look forward and before you look to the future as to where TJ Dillashaw goes next, mind you, or mind I, to let you know that TJ Dillashaw said something incredibly telling after the first fight, said something that no matter the bad blood, no matter the animosity, no matter whatever history the two fighters have, especially when the stakes are as high as a UFC world title fight, Cody Garbrandt was on the mouth of TJ Dillashaw in the context of, you haven't seen the end of Cody Garbrandt. Now, whether Dillashaw knew deep down he wasn't going to get the Mighty Mouse fight and that the UFC's most attractive option was to throw him right into the rematch pool with Garbrandt, sure. Or whether he knew that Garbrandt would get a win or two and build himself back up and put himself right there as the rightful number one contender, Dillashaw knew what he had in front of him. And he took what he had in front of him and he buried it. In pretty much, what are the differences between the two fights? First fight, Cody is a little more patient to start it out. He's not showing his patience that he did in the Dominic Cruz fight, per se, but he is definitely taking his time and picking his shots, which obviously led to him catching TJ Dillashaw with the right hand at the end of the first round. Other than that, Cody looked pretty composed, and then, you know, the world all came tumbling down towards the end. Sorry, I'm making sure that these last few shares are up. All right. Awesome. So with all of that being said, TJ Dillashaw is victorious again. And Cody Garbrandt did get emotional. And you could see it in the way that he packed his punches and loaded up on that right hand. Cody Garbrandt was willing to sit in the pocket and not so much engage in a war, because wars don't last too long when two guys are slinging and sitting in the pocket the way that those two were in the latter part of that first round. That's two guys planting their foot in the center of the octagon and saying, first one to connect wins. What better way to have a rivalry go out like that? However, I'm sure some of us might have wanted a trilogy that has been put to bed, you know, at least on the initial landscape of things. You can't imagine that fight ever happening again. There are four fights that are possible for Dillashaw next, now that we've covered what he's taken care of. Let me go through these options with you before I come to the option that, like I said, was included in my guest appearance as the matchmaker for the MMATakeover.com, the website that I write for. So pretend you're the UFC. Pretend you're sitting amongst the likes of Dana White, Mick Maynard, Sean Shelby, whoever it may be, and you're in the matchmaking room, and somebody, whoever is the voice of reason, especially who's the bantamweights? I think Sean Shelby has the bantamweights. I'm not too positive. But that being said, whoever is in charge of that whole thing and has the landscape already set from point A to point B, or point A to B to C to D, given that's necessary, whoever's job that is in the room, as far as the bantamweight division is concerned, sits everyone down at the table and says, all right, guys, we got four options. And this is assuming that four guys or three guys in this matchmaking room centralize a meeting around figuring out who's going to get a crack at Dillashaw next. And on that particular day where that particular topic comes up, the man that would be in charge says, I have four options. Let's go over these. Number one would be obviously the super fight with Henry Cejudo. And I'll get a little bit more into Cejudo in a second. But on the surface of things, I'm not too crazy about that fight, especially when Cejudo just won the belt. And obviously, we don't need to go into the details of Demetrius Johnson's 11 title defenses. If you know anything about the who's, what, and where of MMA or the UFC in particular, you are very used to Demetrius Johnson wearing 10 pounds of gold around his waist. But now that that's not the case, he should get a crack immediately after it. And I will touch on that momentarily. But that's option number one, is Dillashaw Cejudo in what would quote-unquote be labeled as a super fight, even though we really need to stop throwing that term around loosely, because that's not a super fight. Like, not on the level that BJ Penn GSP or Stipe DC or like an Amanda Nunes Chris Cyborg would be. That fight doesn't fit the bill. That fight would not be invited to the table if the other three had a mind and a heart and an ability to deny one's entry to a table or not. Cejudo Dillashaw would not get a seat at the table, in my opinion. Now, second option, the rightful number one contender fight that is fair. Seems that is something the UFC does not have any business doing nowadays. And that would be against Rafael Assuncao. Rafael Assuncao, of course, coming off that win at UFC 226 against Rob Font, pushing himself to be 11-1 in the UFC at 135 pounds, including a win and a loss against the champion TJ Dillashaw. Whether you agreed with the controversial decision in Brazil, and yeah, I get it, it's Brazil. Yes, I know, Brazil. You know what you carry whenever you walk into Brazil and expect to get a decision. But all of that being said, at the end of the day, when you and I both look at the sheet of paper that depicts TJ Dillashaw and Rafael Assuncao's record, scores 1-1, no matter what. And that carries weight. And obviously, Assuncao beating every single bantamweight he's fought in the UFC, not named TJ Dillashaw, including beating TJ Dillashaw once, and not only beating all of them, but beating 11 of them, shouldn't this guy be the guy? Well, in this day and age of MMA, business is better with guys, and the key word there that you need to focus on, business. Business is booming and better, the big B's, with business being the biggest B of them all. Business is better when you got guys, especially number one contenders, because your champion is going to be who they are, and your champion is likely already having held on to the belt for quite some time. It's not like champions are in a super mega ultra bit of a rush to defend. If you want to fight and you haven't fought in a while, then obviously to each his own. But however, no champion is waking up every day like, God, I want to fight 4 or 5 times a year. That's just not what they're doing. It would be unintelligent. So with all of that being said, Rafael Assuncao needs to step up to the plate if the rightful number one contender would be given his shot. Unfortunately for Assuncao, not only do business pave the ways, business does the talking. Business is a lot better with guys who can talk as well as they can finish fights. And unfortunately for Rafael Assuncao, he's been doing a whole lot of neither of those things as of late. Again, 11-1 in the UFC at 135 pounds. He probably deserves it. But, you know, one finish in his last 7 fights, that says something. And then you move on to the most dangerous fight, option number 3, which would be Marlon Moraes. Marlon Moraes needing just over 1.5 minutes to take care of 2 perennial contenders, Aljamain Sterling and Jimmy Rivera combined. And the Aljamain Sterling knockout was one of the most disturbing and brutal knockouts I've ever seen. Marlon Moraes and TJ Dillashaw would be a fight that I believe would bring out the best in each other. When I say that is the stylistic matchup that the two would carry when they face each other would bring out each other's best attributes. You cannot tell me that a TJ Dillashaw Marlon Moraes fight on the surface does not excite you. Because if you watch MMA and you like MMA and you follow the sport and it doesn't excite you, go to the emergency room. Get your pulse checked. Because that's a hell of a fight. But the problem being Assuncao, ranked ahead of him, has a split decision win over him. And again, Marlon Moraes, I believe, you know, he's got the wins over Dodson and then the aforementioned back-to-back knockouts of Sterling and Rivera. So only 3 UFC wins and that 1 UFC loss coming to the guy ranked 1 spot ahead of him that, by the way, has a win over Dillashaw and has 11 wins in the UFC at 135 pounds to his record. But you can't tell me that that fight with Moraes and Dillashaw wouldn't be the one that is more exciting on the surface. I've spent this entire beginning of this podcast talking about TJ Dillashaw, and that's what he's deserved. He headlined the last UFC card and he won his belt and retained his belt against his rival. But the fight that makes the most sense for me has got to be the rematch with Cruz. Because the surface of the conversation that became inept in and of itself as soon as Dillashaw finished Garbrandt off, the word that was on the tip of everyone's tongues was greatest. Is he the greatest bantamweight of all time? Dillashaw is still relatively young. And Dominic Cruz's clock might be ticking, but Dominic Cruz does have that win in his back pocket. Now, no matter how you scored it at home, and no matter how I might have scored it, 2 out of the 3 people that matter the most gave it to Dominic Cruz. And sure, Dominic Cruz has been out for a couple of years, but if you want to settle the debate of who is the greatest bantamweight of all time, and the consensus is there are only 2 names that enter the fray of the conversation, that being Dillashaw and Cruz. Why this fight would make sense, despite Cruz's layoff and despite Cruz's inactivity due to injury. A, Not only has Cruz not won a fight since beating TJ, TJ has not lost a fight since losing to Dominic. B, if this fight didn't already make a lot of sense, only two men in the history of the UFC bantamweight division have had the belt donned upon them twice. Guess who? TJ Dillashaw and Dominic Cruz. If you want to talk legacy, go the Cruz route. If you want to make quote-unquote super fights that amongst the surface see two guys wearing two belts but really isn't a super fight, make Dillashaw Cejudo. If you want to give it to the guy that fairly deserves it, give it to Sun Cao. He deserves it more than anybody else, period. And if you want to make the fight that would literally have the fans on the edge of their seat the second the official announcement comes across UFC officials' accounts Twitter, make Dillashaw Moraes. You got four options. As for Cejudo, Henry Cejudo defeated Demetrius Johnson by split decision with a pair of 48-47s and a 47-48 going the opposite way. There's been a lot of controversy in how people scored this fight throughout the week. Personally, I gave rounds 1 and 3 to DJ, and I gave rounds 2, 4, and 5 to Cejudo. And the point on the contrary coming from most people being that Cejudo did get takedowns and did secure top control on the ground, but what did he do with the position? What did he do to inflict damage when he was in top position and after he had secured those takedowns? He didn't do much. But did Cejudo control the betterment of what ends up playing a part as the disparity of who wins the round? And by that, I mean who had the biggest in rounds that are as close as the second round, especially the second round. Sometimes you've got to look for that moment that makes you go, oh, that was big. So who does takedown? And as elementary and as simple and as dim-witted as that sounds, you have to remember, on the topic of simple and elementary and dim-witted, we are talking about MMA judges here. They're as elementary and simple and dim-witted as you get. Adelaide Burr still has a job. That's all I really would need to say on that topic. A woman that scored 9 or 8, whatever it was, rounds to Canelo Alvarez still has a job. So we can't look at MMA judges as if they are these matriarchs in their own right that are always going to do the picture-perfect job. That's so beyond false. And everyone judges things differently. Like I said, for me, in the rounds that I gave to Cejudo, 2, 4, and 5, I believe that not only when he secured top control and got the takedowns that ended up playing into his positional advantages, it was also the most significant of advantages of each respective round for me. Leg kicks hurt. All of that stuff hurts. But with all of that being said, if you wanted to give that fight to Demetrius Johnson, I wouldn't have a problem with it. Now on the topic of what you do with Cejudo now, you can't make him a Dillashaw. You can't. You're telling me that you're going to stiff a guy that defended his belt 11 times? From getting the immediate rematch, that it on the topic of immediate rematches, if there was a definition in wherever Webster's version of the mixed martial arts equity of type that we could ever get our hands on, if so, the MMA gods blessed us with it. And the definition was right there in italic letters for immediate rematch. If Demetrius Johnson's face is not the picture sitting next to that definition, then I don't know really what could better serve as to what will depict that picture. The dude defended his belt 11 times. Let me throw a couple of other numbers out. Demetrius Johnson was a UFC champion across a span that stretched over 233 total UFC fight cards and events. 233 cards was the span in which Demetrius Johnson was the UFC flyweight champion. Across those 233 total events, there were the subsequent crowning of 40 new undisputed champions across all other weight divisions. And obviously the 11 successful defenses of his own crown. And obviously the most astonishing number of the bit is 2,142 days he spent at the top of the mountain. If you don't give that guy an immediate rematch, I wouldn't know what to say on the surface of the WME IMG era fully coming into its money fight glow. Because it tries to do money. The WME IMG, since they purchased the UFC from the Fertitta brothers in 2016, have made a priority to, I'm not saying they make a priority to make fights that don't make sense, but they make fights that would be quote unquote more so on the money fight side of things rather than the fights that make sense. Conor McGregor boxed Floyd Mayweather, for fuck's sake. 5-6 years ago, that shit was never happening. And in the days where they were feuding to sign Fedor, even just the slight mention of the word co-promote slivering across your tongue would be enough to put Dana White into a coma. But hey, they made it happen. It's hard to muster into mere words what summary you could give if you were sitting in a classroom and a teacher said, pick up your pencil and give me exactly in your words what Demetrius Johnson's greatness was depicted as during his reign as champion. And I think if I had to describe how great it was, all you have to do is look towards his suplex fucking armbar of Ray Borg. Dude literally threw Ray Borg in the air, caught the armbar midair, and locked it in just at the end of the fight, probably because he felt like it. Submitted Kyoji Horiguchi with a few seconds left, probably just because he felt like it. That's how dominant he was. So for the UFC to even think, for the UFC to even ponder for a millisecond, any fight other than Henry Cejudo, Demetrius Johnson 3 next would be absolutely asinine. You knew as a promotion that your flyweight division was never, ever, ever going to be as hot of a topic as it was until Demetrius Johnson dropped the belt. And look, now he has. Please, 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 for the love of God, do not fall victim to the super fight bug. Do not fall victim to these money fight era bullshit parades. Do the right thing. Make Cejudo Johnson 3 and capitalize on what is by far the biggest fight in the history of a division that the audience largely has shown you that they don't care about for years and years and years. And now you have a fight. I could make an argument that fight could headline a pay-per-view. I really could. Yeah, I really think it could. The rubber match between the only man that has ever beaten Demetrius Johnson at 125 pounds. To show the world that that was not a fluke and that he is really the new sheriff in town. That's the biggest fight in the history of the division. You've got to capitalize on it. And all on top of that, Cejudo, Dillashaw is a terrible matchup for him. Terrible. All right. So now that I've covered the meat and potatoes of that card, largely it was a card that, you know, most people, when you scratch the surface, didn't really care for all that much. So while I liked it and I thought that there were some of the bright and future stars peppered across, whether it was on the prelims or the main card, the narrative there was that a lot of people weren't tuning in just given their initial thought of it, you know, judging a book by its cover. But without further ado, I'm going to kind of not exactly like rapid fire until I get like halfway through the prelims, but just kind of briefly go over my thoughts, especially starting with, man, Hinata Moikano taking out Cub Swanson. Rear naked choke, 4 minutes 15 seconds into round one after he puts Cub Swanson down with a jab. You know, all I really have to take away from this, you know, Hinata Moikano was beating Brian Ortega in Anaheim last summer for the entire fight and got caught in a guillotine by who very well could be and has proven himself to possibly be the best Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioner not named Damian Maia in mixed martial arts today. If there's an argument to that, I would love to hear it. I really would. That being said, Moikano was about a minute and so away from winning that fight, and he'd probably be on the – who knows? He might have the title shot that Ortega now has. However, good things do come to those who wait sometimes. Moikano now finds himself sitting fourth in the rankings on the UFC's official featherweight list. I would love to see a fight with him and Aldo next. That might not be the fight Jose Aldo wants, but I think that that's the fight that makes sense. Either him or Chad Mendes. I don't think Moikano did anyone find it weird? He called for an interim title shot. He asked for an interim title shot. Yeah. Strange. I wondered what was up with that. Does he know something that we don't, or was that just kind of a stupid thing he said in the moment? I don't know. And as for Cub Swanson, you know, the story and the narrative of Cub Swanson's career continues. You know, he's one of the more recognizable names in the sport, and he's one of the more fan-friendly figures and easily recognizable icons that the UFC has on its roster. However, here's some of these numbers. So Cub Swanson, I believe, fell to number 7. And so there would be 7 men sitting in front of him, 1 through 6, and the champion, Max Holloway. So out of the men that are ranked 1 through 6 and the champ in the current featherweight division's rankings, Cub Swanson's career record against those 7 men, and yes, he has fought now all 7 of them, Cub Swanson's career record against every man that is ranked in front of him as it stands right now at this moment on the UFC's official featherweight rankings, 1 win, 7 losses. 5 of those 7 losses, he did not see the final bell. It's a shame. It's tough. You know, Cub is a very talented fighter and, you know, has a great team and has the right amount of trading partners with the right amount of coachability around him. 1-7 in 8 fights against the UFC's top 6 featherweights and the champ. That's a shitty number. That's a shitty stat to have pegged to your name. JJ Aldrich beating Poliana Viana by unanimous decision. Why this fight was on the main card beats me. If I had to guess, Poliana Viana was probably the one attempting to be showcased, given that she showed promise in her debut win over Maya Stevenson. But Poliana Viana's strength obviously relies in their... therefore is carried through on the ground. And if you couldn't figure that out by the first time you saw her throw a jab, if the first jab that she threw didn't tell you immediately
yikes, or oh, or ouch.
I mean, oh, her striking looked sloppy. And if you don't believe me, here's crazy stat number 900 of today's episode. So Viana clearly lost the fight, in my opinion, to a JJ Aldrich that, you know, people would be quick to say all the time, a game JJ Aldrich. It's not even that she was game. She just outpointed her and, you know, I'm looking for the right word to use here. Cohesively beat her mentally and outpointed her with strategic game planning. You could see that in how she strikes. And you could also tell that she trains with the champ, Rose Namajunas, if just by watching her. She's kind of clean on her movement. She bounces around really relaxed. Doesn't throw, just like Rose did, and especially just like Rose did in the fight against Joanna, doesn't throw the volume that we'll see her being amongst the top in significant strikes thrown and landed in the UFC strawweight division, but lands at one of the highest clips. And again, if you don't believe me, how about this? Pollyanna Viana, who clearly lost two of those three rounds, in my opinion, outstruck JJ Aldrich 86-47. So she outstruck the winner by 40 punches. When you look at that and that scratches the surface, the first thing you probably think to yourself is, well, this bitch got hit 40 times more than she dished out. Why is she loser by unanimous decision? Out of those 86 shots that Viana landed, only 42% of them were considered significant strikes. 42% of the 86 punches that landed did damage. So that's saying less than half of Pollyanna Viana's punches that she threw were of any effect whatsoever. Hey, when you're in the UFC, that number cannot be that low. That is a dangerously close to embarrassing clip of how often you are hurting your opponent, especially when you only landed 86, and less than half of them were significant. Significant strike count was 38-37. So yes, Viana outstruck her by 40 strikes total and only one significant strike total. Viana picked her shots. She had the right shots, you know, whatever. I don't see, especially after, you know, there are a lot of up-and-coming contenders in that division. Neither of those two really proved to me that they belong in that conversation. So my favorite fight of the night, though, moving on, Thiago Santos defeating Kevin Holland by unanimous decision. Funky scores. Pair of 29-27s and a 29-26. So for those that don't know the story, something that has become a smash hit in the world of MMA has been Dana White's Tuesday Night Contender Series. On the very first episode this summer, not only the very first episode of this summer's edition of the Contender Series, the very first fight of the entire season. And on my website that I'm the editor and co-founder of at gringogossip.com, I do previews and fight-by-fight previews and recaps and live results to kind of give people a little bit of background information on every single guy that fought on the Contender Series this summer. All 40 of them. And change, given that I had to do some late work for some guys that couldn't fight on short notice or got pulled, visa issues, injury, whatever it may be. So Kevin Holland was matched up against a natural welterweight named Will Santiago, who's challenged for regional belts like such as the CES, lost to Chris Curtis, who also fought on that same Contender Series card. But let me go back to the keywords there. True natural welterweight. Kevin Holland is a massive middleweight. Kevin Holland stands at about 6'4". reach about John Jones-esque, 81, 81 and a half inches on a good day. And I do not know why the Contender Series and Sean Shelby and Mick Maynard, who normally do an absolutely flawless job making fights on the Contender Series, make a fight with Kevin Holland, who is 6'3", against Will Santiago, who's 5'7" on a good day, true welterweight, not a lot of oomph in his positional advantages. All only thing Will Santiago has is heavy hands. But I mean, going against a guy that's so much bigger than him, he's got knockouts at middleweight before, but Kevin Holland is a talented guy. Anyway, I'm getting off topic. Kevin Holland was talking the whole time, and he's coasting, and he's on top, and he's positionally aware of how he is in the right areas that he needs to be to get points en route to what eventually became a lopsided unanimous decision. Well, problem is, on a show where, like this summer, 33 out of the 40 fights this summer ended by way of finish, cruising your way and looking good on your 15 minutes of fame on TV to a unanimous decision, yeah, that shit ain't going to get it done. You're not going to get a contract. Dana White's Tuesday Night Contender Series purpose is you fight in front of Dana White, you get a contract if you impress him out of the 10 people that enter that octagon and have that door closed behind him. Kevin Holland was talking to Will Santiago, to Will Santiago's corner, to the referee, to the fans, to his own corner, and to Dana White and the matchmakers. He was talking and flapping his gums the entire 15 minutes en route to one of the only 7 out of 40 decisions of the entire season. Yeah, you think that prompted Dana to give him a contract? No. Not only did it not prompt him to give him a contract, I wrote this in my matchmaking article. Dana White said on the mic directly after it, subliminally calling Kevin Holland out, saying, and I quote from Dana White, exact quote, "If you don't have a killer instinct, get it. If you come in here and look like Lonzo Menifield did, you're probably going to get signed. If you come in here and look like some of the other guys looked, you're probably not going to get signed." Being that on that particular card, out of those 5 fights, Kevin Holland was the only one that went to decision, he was probably talking to Kevin Holland. And when I say probably, I mean I am certain he was talking to Kevin Holland. So it was very surprising when this fight was announced on a Contender Series episode, literally just 2 weeks before. But Thiago Santos had been the backup plan for Tavares and Adesanya a month prior, and he had a fight fall through. So Dana White goes on a presser. For those of you who are unaware, Dana White goes on a press conference. That does his normal post-fight press conference that he does at almost every pay-per-view that the UFC puts on. And when someone asked him, I can't remember if it was Mike Bone or John Morgan. It was one of the two, I think. It was one of the MMA junkie guys. They ask him something of the sort, like not direct quotations, but something that has the ring of, obviously, the two big performances of the night were Dillashaw and Cejudo. Was there anyone else on the card, maybe a little bit further down, that impressed you? And Dana immediately cracks a smile from ear to ear and says, "You know, Kevin Holland." Man, where do I begin with what Kevin Holland did to make a name for himself? The story is what fascinates me about it the most. Kevin Holland was all but completely off the UFC's radar, despite how much talent he had. Holds a win over current middleweight Jeff Neal. Holland, when Dana brought him up, Dana said that when Santos' fight fell through, he said to Sean and Mick, "Hey, why don't we call some of the Contender Series guys?" Nobody took the fight. Nobody at all. all of the Contender Series guys, and I think off the top of my head, I might be wrong, I think four middleweights were signed on the Contender Series this summer. And on top of those four, I think two or three others were winners in their fight by way of finish and didn't get contracts. All of this being said, what does Kevin Holland do when he gets in for this short notice UFC opportunity? Does he learn his lesson and stop talking shit? No, he's still talking shit. He is still a comedian. Let's do some highlights of some of the things he said. Here's some of the things that came out of Kevin Holland, or better. The dude is an absolute comedian, and I've spent a little bit longer on this talking about the guy that lost the fight, being that Thiago Santos was the one that got his hand raised here in a dangerous fight. Kevin Holland is a comedian, man, and those are the type of guys that even if you don't win at the end of the day, people are going to want to watch you fight next time, and Dana alluded to that, and that's why he's going to get another fight. In L.A., and the stars are all out, and Chris Pratt is sitting in the front row, and half the Chili Peppers are sitting in the row behind him. Dana said out of all the celebrities, they all liked Holland the best, and here's why. Kevin Holland's UFC debut featured, he was introduced by Bruce Buffer as the first ever self-denounced Kung Fu fighter. Okay. He attempted some sort of flying omoplata like less than 40 seconds in. Okay. He was continuously laughing, smiling, and talking shit all while this absolute murderer, Thiago Santos, is in his open guard, raining down vicious ground and pound on his fucking face. After getting clipped with a head kick early in round two, Kevin Holland deliberately dropped his own mouth guard out of his mouth and attempted to fight without it. That's when I lost my shit, bro. That's when I absolutely, I literally jumped off my couch and said, this man just wanted to fight without his mouth guard. Mirgliotta was like, no, sir. I was weak. He open hand bitch slapped Santos also while he was in full guard. That had me weak as fuck too. And then lastly, some of the mid-fight quotes. I'm telling you, these quotes came out of Kevin Holland's mouth clear as day amidst the 15 minutes after the octagon door closed behind him and murderer in his own right, Thiago Santos. Quote, this sucks. Why are you hitting me so hard? Bro, this shit is crazy, while Santos was attempting to sink in an arm triangle. Hey, I got an idea, he shouted to his corner after he got taken down. And Dana, what the fuck? I had a blast watching that fight. 29-26, though. I don't know if there were two 10-8 rounds, and I've spent way too much time talking about this fight, but yeah. All right, so... And then briefly going down the prelims, Pedro Munhoz, how Brett Johns survived three Pedro Munhoz guillotines, completely useless legs rendered from leg kicks, and a couple of head kicks that clipped him. Miracle. I don't think Brett Johns' stock really fell at all in that fight. That was a war. And if it weren't for Cejudo and Johnson putting on the best fight in the history of the flyweight division, that was easily fight of the night. Round two was one of the best rounds of the year, for real. Absolutely. That was a crazy round. Whew. All right. Yeah, Munhoz got it done. I match made him up with, I'd like to see him fight the winner of Aljamain Sterling and Cody Stan. Ricky Simón defeated Montel Jackson by a trio of 29-28s. I'd like to see Ricky Simón fight Manny Bermudez. I wanted to see him fight Benito Lopez. Apparently they have history. There's some sort of animosity dating back to their LFA days. But, dude, he looked like a beast in those wrestling exchanges. And in his position advancements, what wins you fights is when you are not only – obviously when you're actively looking for the finish and it's egregiously obvious that you are getting ready to look for and not – and if not look for, secure the finish. That's a great indicator if you're winning a fight. Cough, cough, hint, hint for those judges in Idaho. still don't forgive you for some of those scores on the Boise card. Anyway, another way to look good for the judges and win fights almost every single time is continuously and actively look for position advancements. Ricky Simone was constantly either looking to secure a takedown or looking to secure a throw or looking to lift Montel Jackson up off of his feet, so on and so forth. And it ended up getting in the win. Montel Jackson towered over him too. That is a big bantamweight. And he took that fight on short notice. I don't think we're done seeing him. Ricardo Ramos beating Kyung Ho Kong by split decision. This fight was a little closer than I thought it was going to be. I thought Ramos looked a little underwhelming. And to be honest with you, I thought Kyung Ho Kong may have won that fight. In my opinion, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that I did score that fight 2-1 for Kong. Ramos almost locked in a knee bar, and it was super deep in round two, and he might have been closer to getting the finish in multiple occasions. Close fight, though. A fight I did have a problem with, though. Shaman Marais defeats Matt Sales by unanimous decision, a trio of 29-28s. Even though Marais was warned twice for blatant eye pokes, in which, so obviously, if a point would have rightfully been taken away, we have a draw, and both men are going home with that win bonus instead of just Marais. I don't find that fair. And quick side note to that, this summer's Contender Series fighters get off to an 0-3 start. Kevin Holland, Montel Jackson, Matt Sales. I would not expect that trend to continue, though. Okay, moving on. And what was by far, in my opinion, the most holy shit type of performance on the prelims, if not on the entire card, maybe outside of TJ Dillashaw? How about Alex Perez? Sheesh, man. Knocking out Jose Shorty Torres, who was undefeated as a pro, undefeated as an amateur, a two-division champion from a very respected regional organization in Titan Fighting Championships, already 1-0 inside the octagon, regarded as one of the top prospects in the flyweight division, heralded as well by Demetrius Johnson earlier in the week as a guy down the road that could be looking to fight for that belt. If Demetrius Johnson is saying during fight week anything about a fight outside of his, that's one thing. But for him to literally handpick you out and anoint you as a potential future number one contender to be just one fight into your UFC octagon career, Alex Perez took that hype and said, yep, nope, this is mine now, bye. Oh, 104 significant strikes in the first round. Jeez. Did not see that coming. I did pick Perez to win. I did not pick Perez to win like that. Unheard of. 104 significant strikes landed out of 136 thrown in 4 minutes and 4 seconds. No, 3 minutes and 46 seconds. I'm sorry. Even better. Tremendous. Give that guy a top 15 opponent immediately. And also another future star in her own right, Wiley Zhang, outpointed Danielle Taylor. I thought Wiley Zhang looked light years better than either of the main card strawweights did, Aldrich and Viana. Wiley Zhang looked a million light years better than both of them. You'd have to imagine she's going to land on that Beijing card they just announced on November 24th. And don't look now, but the UFC has all of a sudden stumbled upon this really, really nice group of young, up-and-coming Chinese talent. Wiley Zhang is widely considered one of the best strawweights in the world and is one of the most highly anticipated debuts in that division in recent memory. She got it done. She's 1-0 in the UFC. Song Kanan, 2-0 in the UFC with two knockouts. Song Yadong, 2-0 in the UFC with two knockouts. Yan Zhaonan, also in the strawweight division, 2-0 in the UFC. Guan Wang, 1-0 in the UFC. And obviously, the poster board for Chinese MMA in the UFC right now, or the poster boy, would have to be Li Jingliang, for whatever that's worth. He's 8-3. He's quietly 8-3 in the UFC, and is a killer in his own right. But, you know, try to stay away from that guy's eye pokes. Don't put that guy in a guillotine. He might gouge your eyes out. And lastly, Marlon Vera on short notice. He was the biggest favorite on the fight card. He TKOs Waleji Buren by a body shot. I want to go in depth on that sometime soon. Not right now, obviously, because I'm kind of just blowing through these. But man, the relevance of body shots, body kicks, solar plexus targets, all of it. It's becoming really, really big in MMA. So that does it for the UFC 227 postmortem review. So now, as I promised on my last MMA edition, not including the Nate Diaz one, with these weekly editions of the MMA Bottom Line, I am going to go through all of the fights that were announced for this week. And, you know, just like last week, good Lord, were there a whole lot this week. Fight announcements coming out everywhere. And obviously the big one being what I will lead up to towards the end. That being Khabib Nurmagomedov and Conor McGregor in what looks upon the surface as potentially the biggest pay-per-view in UFC history, and some are pegging it as the first ever 2 million buy rate donor. That being said, let's get to it. So how this works is I will go through all of the new fight announcements slash news, starting in order with the closest to now, the event closest to now, which would be 2 weeks from tonight in Lincoln, Nebraska for UFC Fight Night 135, Gaethje versus Vic. And it stretches all the way to going in order of UFC events, goes all the way to UFC Fight Night 139, with a couple of events not having new fights announced as well. UFC Fight Night 139, November 10th in Denver, Colorado. That's the 25th anniversary card, given that the UFC 1 was in Denver on November 12th, 1993. And after that, I will briefly touch on the new Bellator things, and then I will have my two cents on Khabib and McGregor, and I'll get out of here. So, while there's no new fight announcements for the card in Lincoln 2 weeks from today, gotta address and have to point out that following the subsequent removal of Antonio Braga Neto, which I mentioned on my last episode, and if those that are listening to this, I would have to imagine you're pretty well versed in the MMA newsosphere. You already knew that Marcus Perez filled in. So after that happened, and coincidentally, after someone not named Demetrius Johnson has the flyweight belt, looky, looky here. We have our first flyweight fight on a main card outside of last week's Johnson-Cejudo fight, title fight, of the entire year. It took almost 9 months for a non-125-pound title fight to make a main card. Do we think that that is a coincidence? If you don't think that's a coincidence, try again, my friend. That is exactly why that happened. There's interest in this division again. There is something, it's obvious, it's arguably as hot of a topic as it was when it was first announced with a four-man tournament and Ian McCall and Demetrius Johnson fought to a draw. It's there, man. It's there, and I don't think it's going anywhere, especially if Henry Cejudo wins that third fight. Please, UFC, make that fight. Then I guarantee you that's how people get into it. I'm not saying that's what I'm rooting for. Don't really care. I'm objective about it. But anyway. All right. So now, bang, bang for these new fight announcements. UFC 228, September 8th in Dallas, got two welterweight bouts, two awesome welterweight bouts. How about Diego Sanchez? Ultimate Fighter Season 1 winner Diego Sanchez, still going strong. He will take on the Welshman Craig White, who was just last seen on May 27th as a short notice replacement in the co-main event against Neil Magny in Liverpool. Craig White will get a second opportunity in the UFC against a legend in his own right, Diego Sanchez, who has, I think Diego Sanchez has lost his last two, if not his last three. He'll probably be an underdog in that fight. He's going to be undersized. And then another welterweight, absolute cracker of a fight, Both of these guys have won their last two, and both of these guys have won those last two fights by way of finish. Nico, the motherfucking hybrid Price against Abdul Razak Al-Hassan, who's coming off two consecutive KOs of Sabaho Massi, the second one being a lot more convincing. That's a hell of a welterweight fight between two up-and-coming prospects that are both going to be surely top 15 contenders if their potential sees their ceiling. Nico Price gets the edge in creativity. Al-Hassan probably has the edge in as far as raw power in his hands is concerned. That's a fight that I promise you, you need to not be sleeping on. That one's going to be fireworks. Moving on, for the week after the UFC's debut in Russia, UFC Fight Night 136 in Moscow, Douglas Silva de Andrade unfortunately has pulled out of his contest with surging and quick rising bantamweight contender Petr Yan, and Petr Yan is in need of a new opponent, and something tells me that they're going to either have tremendous amounts of difficulty getting that new opponent and or he's not going to get one. If you are at 135 pounds and you want to take a fight against a guy like Petr Yan in his home country, good luck with that, buddy. Like I said, I would not be surprised if they don't find a fight for him in time. And then they just keep throwing Cajun Johnson to the wolves. He must be in desperate need of some money. Cajun Johnson directly, literally, not even now, 2 weeks to the day removed of his first round submission loss to another Russian stud, Islam Makhachev. He's booked against a different Russian stud, Rustam Khabibov, 22-3 in the UFC, 22-3 as a pro, 8-2. In the UFC, I would imagine Khabibov will be a massive favorite in that one as well. Maybe Cajun Johnson should just keep his mouth shut. As far as talking about the UFC and bashing the UFC and bashing Dana White goes, Islam Makhachev and Rustam Khabibov in back-to-back fights? Jeez, man. UFC Fight Night 137 in Sao Paulo, Brazil, the week after. It was announced on the Contender Series that Mark Godbeer... This was the very first fight that scratched the surface on this card. It was Mark Godbeer and Luis Enrique both making their light heavyweight debuts. Godbeer is now out of that fight and in steps in another Dana White Tuesday Night Contender Series contract winner from this summer in Ryan Superman Spann. So Ryan Spann will take on Enrique and will go to hear the Who Famojes in Enrique's favor for his debut. The monster that will become UFC 229, as I previously stated, could end up becoming the all-time leader in pay-per-view buys, is starting to take shape now with, obviously, Conor McGregor and Khabib Nurmagomedov at the forefront and where all of the eyes will be. It definitely makes a lot of sense to not book another title fight and save them for other cards and to maximize those other cards' potential rather than, you know, loading up an undercard of Conor McGregor's with stars, which, A, you know, like I said, wouldn't make sense as far as boosting the potential of other cards, and B, would not make Conor too happy. For those that know anything about Conor McGregor, he does not like big stars on his undercards. That being said, the co-main event for what is consensusly being hyped up as the future pay-per-view king on UFC history, UFC 229, that's October 6th, from the T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas, Nevada. The co-main event for that card, it's still not official, but it's been verbally agreed to for quite a few days now, will be another chance for Derek Lewis to try to get some shine in a co-main event in Las Vegas. It all sounds too familiar, and I don't even want to think about his fight with Ngannou. Nonetheless, Derek Lewis gets called out by Alexander Volkov to fight him in Russia. He says no can do, and now they have a date in the co-main bill. And Vegas, as the second up from the top from what is the biggest UFC fight arguably ever. A few other good fights on that card. A really, really interesting light heavyweight bout between Ovince St. Preux and Dominic Reyes. Dominic Reyes, widely considered the best prospect at 205. He's 3-0 in the UFC with 3 first round finishes and 12-0 with 12 finishes and 11 of them coming in the first round in his career. Women's strawweight action, 7th-ranked Michelle Waterson will take on 8th-ranked Felice Herrig. Yana Kunitskaya returns to the same arena where she saw her title shot and title hopes dashed against Cyborg in March. She'll drop back down to 135 pounds to take on Lena Landsberg. And a very, very overlooked, I can foresee already, and what will be an overlooked welterweight scrap between Ryan LaFlair and Tony Martin, that all of those fights will be on the undercard of one Khabib and Conor McGregor. Then the UFC takes 3 weeks off and lands in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. As I said, you know, there's just been so many fights getting announced, and this card was kind of at the forefront of new fight announcements. That card's headlined by Volkan Ozdemir and surging light heavyweight contender Anthony Smith, and that card got to its name this week. Women's bantamweights, in my opinion, this fight could be a fight for their jobs. I could definitely see, especially in the case of the latter, the loser being given their walking papers, and the latter being, out of the two, number 14, Sarah Morris and Talita Bernardo. Could definitely see Bernardo getting the boot. If she loses this fight, she would become 0-3 in the UFC and 5-4 as a pro. Light heavyweights, number 10, Misha Cirkunov, and number 13, Patrick Cummins, as well as light heavyweights, Jean Vellante and Ed Herman. At bantamweight, Andre Sugumtad gets a chance to redeem himself in his first fight since the mental errors against Sean O'Malley, and he takes on it seems like it was a long time ago, but he was once considered one of the top prospects in Canadian MMA, and he's dropping to bantamweight. That is Gavin Tucker, Sugumtad and Gavin Tucker. Nasrat Haqparast, who impressed a lot of people in Germany, gets a quick turnaround against Tibal Guti. How Tibal Guti at 1-4 still has a job in the UFC, I'm not sure. And then a really interesting welterweight fight between two talented 170ers looking to get back on track. Nordine Taleb will take on Sean Strickland. And then the week after that would be Madison Square Garden. There's no new fights announced for that. Everyone is on the edge of their seat to see what the main event for that will be, being that that is the only fight up until November 10th. The only card put on by the UFC up to November 10th that has not had its main event revealed. And then fast forward a week to that aforementioned 25th anniversary card in Denver, UFC Fight Night 139. That's headlined by Frankie Edgar and the Korean zombie Chan Sung Jung. That being said, oh, sorry, got a little distracted there. That being said, a fight that was initially booked for the Khabib McGregor undercard and got moved, wonder why, a top five flyweight tilt between Joseph Benavidez and Ray Borg. Here's an interesting one. Women's bantamweight, and you will not hear me very often say anything with interesting and women's bantamweight in the same sentence. But a couple of fighters that I'm intrigued to see how they will react and or bounce back to recent adversity, that is Raquel Pennington and Jermaine Durand to me. They will meet on that card, as well as a couple of strawweight tilts. The latest Dana White Tuesday Night Contender Series contract winner, and a girl who is very ambitious and has, I believe they said on the Contender Series, this fighter, Macy Barber, has a timer set in her phone that tells her how much longer she has to break John Jones' record as the youngest UFC champion ever. I'm definitely not one to be a Debbie Downer on someone's dreams, but I mean, with the way the UFC is operated today and who gets title shots and who doesn't, that seems very far-fetched. However, she will take on Maya Stevenson in her UFC debut on November 10th. In addition to that, another fight that I would consider, it has to be for me, I don't see any other way around it, a fight to avoid getting those walking papers between the two victims in the UFC of Mackenzie Dern. That being Ashley Yoder and Amanda Bobby Cooper. With Ashley Yoder being 0-3 in the UFC and Amanda Bobby Cooper being 3-4 collectively as a professional. Granted, those four losses came to Cynthia Calvillo, Tatiana Suarez, Dern, and someone else that's almost undefeated. You got to imagine dropping to 3-5 as a pro will probably get you the boot. So that being said, that fight's in. Also, outside of the UFC, Bellator welterweight Grand Prix matchups were announced. Man, is this going to be fucking fun. A Bellator welterweight Grand Prix. I said if they were going to do another Grand Prix, it would either need to be in the at welterweight or at featherweight. Those two divisions at Bellator are absolutely loaded. Check out these matchups. Obviously, one we already know is the trilogy, the head of the trilogy between Douglas Lima and Andrei Korechkov. Everyone's going to be interested to see how Douglas Lima will come back after losing his belt to McDonald. That'll be on Bellator's debut on DAZN, September 29th. And then the rest of them don't have dates yet. But the one that everyone for sure was hoping would be a part of the list, holy shit, we're going to get Paul Daly versus Michael Venom Page. Oh, man. Is that the most exciting fight in the world of MMA outside of the UFC? I really think that it could be. That is a hell of a fight that's going to make some local Brits happy for sure. And then that's on the left side of the bracket. So you got Lima, Korechkov, Paul Daly, and MVP on that side of the bracket. Any which way of fights that would be made for the semifinals, I would be thrilled with. And then on the right side, so a lot of people's question was if Rory McDonald was going to enter this tournament, not only if he was going to enter this tournament, but will his belt be on the line? Another disclaimer about this tournament, every single fight is five rounds. Every single one of them, whether it's a quarterfinal, semifinal, alternate fight, if you are fighting under the distinction of being inside the welterweight Grand Prix above the Bellator banner, you're fighting five rounds. That was made clear. So with that being said, Rory McDonald's belt will be on the line, and the guy that will get the guy that will get Rory McDonald's first title defense shot after McDonald takes care of or fails to take care of his business with Gegard Mousasi, that man is John Fitch, former UFC welterweight title challenger John Fitch. I think that's a smart move, especially when it's no secret John Fitch doesn't have the most exciting style. And it's also no secret that Rory McDonald does well against wrestlers. He holds a win over Tyron Woodley, amongst other guys that call themselves wrestlers. So Rory McDonald and John Fitch on that side. And the other fight on that side of the bracket, which is an amazing fight, but very interesting for me, being that the winner of this is now dubbed the quote-unquote number one contenders fight. Even though, like, it doesn't really matter. The winner of this tournament is going to end up with the belt regardless. And if you win fights in this tournament, you're going to get a shot at that belt regardless. But it was very interesting to me to see the first, from a title shot standpoint and with the belt being on the line standpoint, as far as seeding is concerned, it makes all the sense in the world. How about Neiman Gracie and Ed Ruth? Two of Bellator's not exactly best kept secrets, but two of Bellator's brightest and flashiest prospects, with Gracie being on the ground, obviously coming from the historic Gracie family, and Ed Ruth, just an absolute monster, three-time national champion in wrestling at Penn State. I mean, the fact that someone's O has got to go in that one is incredibly enthralling for me. And then on top of that, the fact that the winner of that fight is going to fight for the belt. Could you imagine Ed Ruth fighting for the belt by the middle of next year? That's crazy, man. That is crazy. And then finally, the alternate fight. This will be two guys that will be able to step in case anyone else gets hurt. Lorenz Larkin and Yaroslav Amazov. Number one guy I do not want to see is Yaroslav Amazov. Dude is an animal. 20-0. I'm going to pick him to beat Larkin in that fight too. And of course, what would this segment be if it did not address the lone important Bellator fight announcement this week? And that is Aaron Pico is going to be tested, ladies and gentlemen. Who in a lot of people's minds is the best pound-for-pound prospect in the entire world of MMA, given his attributes and accolades and decorations as a martial artist as a whole. That man is Aaron Pico. And Aaron Pico will get former 135-pound title challenger Leandro Higo in his next fight. I'm excited to see him get tested. Is he probably still leagues ahead of Higo? Yeah. But at least we know now, once he wins this fight, come on, baby. Let's see him against the McKees. Let's see him against the Emmanuel Sanchez's. Let's see him against the Daniel Vichels. He looks ready. If he beats a former title challenger, whether it's at 135 or 145 or wherever, he's ready. So once again, I'd like to thank you for joining me. And sorry, I have a there we go. All right. So I'm going to cap off today's episode with obviously a few words on what we are dubbing and what many people are categorizing as in a league of its own as far as the biggest fights in the history of the sport. That fight being none other than Khabib Nurmagomedov and Conor McGregor. If you had a problem with how they put the fucking bus gate in the promo, if you had a problem with them putting that in the promo, you're probably the same person. You're probably the same person that asks for a manager at Panera when one shade of lettuce isn't the same kind of green as the rest. Fuck off with that. You really expected them not to? Come on. You got to understand one thing. You got to understand something about when Conor McGregor fights, there are three things that come with it. Number one is the invasion of the casuals. People that have not seen a single fucking second of mixed martial arts for the entirety of a calendar year will check Bleacher Report and look at Snowden's articles and look and see who and what and where it is at as far as the location on the card. They will not watch Lewis and Volkov. They will not watch St. Preux and Reyes. The invasion of the casuals will come in as soon as Conor McGregor and Khabib Nurmagomedov make the walk. That's one. The three things that come with Conor McGregor fighting. One is the invasion of the casuals. Number two is obviously the money. Number three is controversy, whether you expect it to be good or bad. And in the case of what happened in April, it was very bad. But what I continuously saw and what I kind of echoed from my colleagues, what I write with, and people that I've listened to on podcasts alike, is that what can you do when you fear the UFC and your biggest star just absolutely cataclysmically shit his pants as far as his reputation is concerned, and gives you a black eye? Because now not only is your biggest star in the headlines for the wrong reason, this just delays his return even longer. What do you do? Do you sit there, pout, cry, shit your diaper, and act like there's no way you can come back for that? No. You make positive out of a negative. You get lemons, you make lemonade. And that's literally all what has bundled into the creating and dubbing of what many believe is going to be the biggest fight in UFC history. Again, I saved this for the end of this episode because I didn't want to go all in depth on it. We have like literally less than 8 weeks to talk about it, but I do want to talk about the most important aspect of it, and that being that this fight is for the belt, right? If there's a division that has had a long-standing debate of who is the real champ and who was stripped of interim belts, of whether they fell and tripped over extension cords, you know, I hate to single out Tony Ferguson like that, but it's a rough life in that way, you know, and crowning a guy that just beat number 10 in the world to get the belt that he, you know, had probably deserved for a long time. There are probably no more foggy title pictures in the past 365 days than there were at 155 pounds. And Conor McGregor's absence is large to thank for that. However, the UFC's lightweight title picture now has become incredibly simple. Maybe not so, I kind of worded my entry into that wrong, because maybe not the title picture, because if Khabib wins this fight, no matter how he wins it, no matter if he finishes him on the ground in 30 seconds or if he makes it a long, drawn-out torture fest, if Khabib wins, that is a separate avenue the UFC has to go, because now they are moving forward with a Conor McGregor belt-less figure. Now, there are a lot of things you could do if Khabib wins. But on the scale of if Conor wins, and Conor's biggest rival and dance partner for the two biggest pay-per-views in the history of the sport, Nate Diaz, who fights almost a month to the day afterwards, do you really think that the UFC is not already licking their chops, thinking that this could not be matching up more brilliantly? And here's why. I said this on my podcast last week when I talked about the Nate Diaz fight announcement. I want you to really, really think about it. And think about the era that we're in. Turn this fucking hat forward. Think about the era that we're in. We always talk about money fights. And, you know, I spoke earlier in abundance about how Rafael Assuncao on paper is clearly the deserving guy to get the next crack at TJ Dillashaw. But it would surprise a lot of us if that ended up coming to fruition. And with that being said, I see one outcome with three different scenarios out of a possible four. Because if Nate Diaz beats Dustin Poirier, I do not care what you say. I do not care what you think. I do not care if Dustin Poirier takes a fight on short notice a month later against Jesus Christ himself and knocks him out in 5 seconds. If Nate Diaz beats Dustin Poirier at Madison Square Garden on November 3rd, Nate Diaz is getting a title shot. Watch. Does not matter if there's a Tony Ferguson sitting in front of him. It doesn't matter. If Nate Diaz takes out a guy in Dustin Poirier who is on a three-fight main event against former world champions, quote, whether you believe that Justin Gaethje's World Series of Fighting World Championship is meritable, that's up to you. Regardless, Anthony Pettis, former UFC lightweight champion, finished him. Justin Gaethje, one of the biggest nightmares in this entire division to fight, period, and was 18-1 at the time, finished him. Eddie Alvarez, former UFC lightweight champion, former Bellator lightweight champion, two-time Bellator lightweight champion, finished him. He's won 7 of his last 8. He's unbeaten in his last 5. But he's only lost his two, He's won 10 of his last 12, I believe, off the top of my head. And those two losses in those 12 fights coming against rangy, long southpaws, like Nate Diaz. However, I'm not trying to go into the match above it, but if Nate Diaz can effectively storm the castle, as vulgar as he likes, as nonchalantly and ever so basking in the aura of I don't give a fuckness that he carries, and he takes out Dustin Poirier, given the role Dustin Poirier is on, Nate Diaz is getting a title shot. You deal with it. I mean, they're not going to make Tony Khabib for a fifth time. And where this brings my point to a head and how I can wrap this in a bow and put it under the Christmas tree right here. Four scenarios. Connor win plus Nate win. No, I'll save that for last. A Connor loss plus a Nate loss. Connor Nate 3. McGregor Diaz 3. A Connor loss plus a Nate win. I could still see Connor Diaz 3. I could see Nate getting the title shot to fight Khabib 2. But if for some reason, wherever or however the UFC decides to fuck themselves out of so much money and they do something else, probably try to make Khabib Ferguson for a fifth time for whatever reason. I would likely see Connor losing plus Nate winning, resulting Connor Diaz 3. And for a guy like Nate Diaz, what do you think? Hey, Nate, shiny belt, or hey, Nate, lots of cash. Cash is going to be his choice of destination. I can't even imagine. Could you imagine Conor McGregor defeating Khabib, and then a month later, if the odds were to hold right now, it would be an upset. Obviously, that line is gonna move farther than the Polar Express, or more. I don't know about farther, but it's definitely not gonna sit at where Conor McGregor is right now. I think he's at plus 155, according to Bet Online. He is. Could you imagine Conor McGregor and Nate Diaz what would both be upset wins to result in the creating of the biggest trilogy ever, of the biggest rivalry ever, piggybacking off the two current biggest pay-per-views in the sport ever, coming to a head, settling the score in the trilogy finale once and for all, with a belt on the line. That would be absolutely fucking insane. And if Conor wins and Nate wins, it's going to happen. Conor McGregor versus Nate Diaz 3 for the UFC lightweight title. Holy shit. That would be so insane. The only scenario where that fight doesn't make sense, and again, we're not going to hold the UFC to a standard of never making fights that don't make sense, is if Conor beats Khabib, wins the belt, and Nate loses to Dustin Poirier. And then, if that were to happen, me in these scenarios, that creates three scenarios. Number one, Conor defends the 155-pound belt against the true number one contender. Yeah, probably not happening. Why would we? If Conor wins the belt, if Conor wins, do you think the first thing that's going to come out of everyone's mouth is, ooh, I can't wait to see who he defends the belt against and fights next? No! People are going to be like, fucking awesome. The lightweight division is back in a standstill. Because people would be correct to believe that he's not going to defend it. Option number one, Conor defends the 155-pound belt. Very unlikely. And this is all speaking if Conor wins and Nate loses. Number one, Conor defends the 155-pound belt. Not happening. Number two, Connor says, fuck the belt. I'm bigger than the belt. Vacates and fights Nate anyways for the biggest payday and what would probably be a bigger fight than Connor and Khabib right now. Still, the trilogy, it's got to happen. It's going to happen. It's going to be the biggest fight ever. And if Connor were to win the belt and were to literally, he would usher in a new era by saying, fuck this belt. I want the most money. Nate Diaz is going to be what gives me that amount of money. I want to win this. I want to not only settle the score, but I already have settled the score. I want to be emergent as the winner in this. If there's one guy on the planet that has the power, the fortitude, the following, and the balls to say, fuck this belt, I don't want this belt. And it kind of makes sense while he says it, it's Conor McGregor. And then lastly, Conor goes up to, lastly, if Conor wins and Nate loses, Conor vacates the 155-pound belt to go up to 170 to challenge whoever wins between Woodley or Till. Or if that fight ends quickly enough and Covington has a say in there, whoever ends up getting the belt at 170 pounds, which I think would be a horrible idea. So do not be surprised if Conor wins that fight, hangs onto the belt up until Nate fights. And if Nate loses his fight, Conor says, fuck the belt. I'm bigger than the belt. I've came and won and taken every belt that has been offered on a mantle in front of me since I fought in Cage Warriors. You know, it's whatever. It would be whatever to Connor. All right, I have run out of time. It's been an awesome episode. I have gotten just about everything I needed to say off my chest. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you guys for viewing. I saw there were some people popping in and out of the live chat here on YouTube. And for those watching on YouTube, I apologize for my constant fidgeting of the hair and the hat. I will probably need to get better at that. And for those listening on iTunes, be aware that I will come out with another episode tonight, episode 30, with my good friend Justin Riggs. That's right. I will be back with another podcast tonight with my friend Justin Riggs for the 30th edition of The Bottom Line. Until then, quick shout out to my friends over at betmma.tips. You can find my handicaps at betmma.tips/DavidsonBakerGG. Until then, you know, quiet week in MMA for the next couple of weeks. I will not be back to discuss MMA until a week from today. Hopefully there aren't as many fight announcements up until then. Who am I kidding? I love them. We need them. Let's get them all announced regardless. For those who listen to my podcast, see you tonight, bitches. I'm out.